So hello again, everyone. I hope you're enjoying your meal. It's now my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Dr. Philip Lowe, Governor of the Reserve Bank. Phil holds a PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a Bachelor of Commerce degree in Economics and Econometrics from the University of New South Wales. He's authored numerous papers, including on the linkages between monetary policy and financial stability. Phil commenced as governor in September 2016. He's chair of the Reserve Bank Board and Payment System Board and chair of the Council of Financial Regulators. He's a member of the Financial Stability Board. Prior to his current role, Phil held the positions of Deputy Governor, Assistant Governor Economic, and Assistant Governor Financial System. Phil also spent 2 years at the Bank for International Settlements working on financial stability issues. Dr. Lowe is chair of the Financial Markets Foundation for Children and a director of the Anika Foundation. He's also chair of the Committee of the Global Financial System of the Bank for International Settlements. The Governor is a signatory to the Banking and Finance Oath. Please welcome Phil to the podium.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for the support you're showing to the ABE. It's great to see a full room, so thank you for coming along. Stephen, thank you for that introduction. This is the fifth time that I've had the privilege of addressing the annual dinner of the ABE, so thank you once again for having me back. One recurring theme of my talks over these five addresses is the likelihood that interest rates will remain low for an extended period of time. Certainly, much lower on average than before the financial crisis. This theme remains just as relevant today as it has over recent years. As I discussed in the Sir Leslie Melville lecture at ANU a month ago, low interest rates are not a temporary phenomenon. Rather, they're likely to be with us for some time and the result of some powerful global forces that are affecting interest rates everywhere. Given this assessment, it's not surprising that there is a lot of discussion internationally about the use of so-called unconventional monetary policies. People are rightly asking, if interest rates are going to stay low and be constrained by the lower bound, what other monetary policy options are there? And I've been part of these international discussions through chairing the Committee on the Global Financial System, which Stephen mentioned. Last month, this committee published a report titled Unconventional Monetary Policy Tools, a Cross-Country Analysis. The report reviews the experience with the use of unconventional monetary policy tools and discusses how these tools can be used by central banks to achieve their objectives. If you're interested in these issues and you haven't looked at the report, I encourage you to go onto the BIS website and have a look at it. This evening, I'd like to summarise some of the key observations of this report and then explore how those observations might be applied to Australia. If you've looked at the report, you'll see it discusses four unconventional monetary policy tools. The term unconventional monetary policy has now become, unfortunately, the conventional shorthand for a wide range of policies, although I'm not sure it's the best terminology. I say this because most of these tools have long been in the toolkit of central banks, and they've been used in the past in one way or another. What has been unconventional over recent times is the way these tools have been used, often in combination and the scale of their use. The first of the four tools discussed in this report is negative policy rates. And this is the one tool that is truly unconventional. Prior to the financial crisis, it was widely thought that zero was the lower bound for the policy interest rate. So it was common to talk about, as the Americans say, the ZLB, the zero lower bound. It was thought that if interest rates went below zero, people would move their savings out of bank deposits and into banknotes, rather than to be charged by their bank for holding money in the bank. But zero has not turned out to be the constraint that it was once thought to be. So we now talk about the ELB, the effective lower bound, rather than the ZLB. While countries with negative interest rates have indeed seen some shift to banknotes, it hasn't been on a very large scale. I think this reflects the fact that bank deposits are very useful for making transactions, and the fact that in most countries with negative interest rates, banks have chosen to set a floor of zero on deposit rates for retail and small business customers. They've judged that it doesn't make sense either commercially or politically to charge these group of customers a negative interest rate. So in many of these countries, zero has been the effective floor. It's worth pointing out that negative interest rates have really just been a European phenomenon. As you can see in this first graph, policy interest rates have been negative in the euro area, in Denmark, in Sweden, and in Switzerland. Rates have been lowest in Switzerland at -0.75%. The only country outside of Europe that's had negative interest rates is in Japan. But in Japan, only a very small share of bank reserves, around 5% at the Bank of Japan, earn negative interest rates, and that negative interest rate is just -0.1%. So it's really just a European phenomenon. The second unconventional monetary policy tool discussed in the report is the extended use of central bank liquidity operations. In response to the financial crisis, many central banks made significant changes to their normal operations to deal with strains in financial markets that were impairing the supply of credit to the real economy. While the specifics differ across countries, the changes to market operations included expanding the range of collateral accepted, providing much larger amounts of liquidity, extending the maturity profile of liquidity operations, increasing the range of eligible counterparties, and providing funding to banks at below the cost that was then prevailing in highly stressed markets, sometimes on the condition that the banks provide credit to households and businesses. This next graph shows the size of the extended liquidity operations of the major central banks. As you can see, the biggest operations were in the crisis period of 2008 and 9, but there was also significant liquidity support provided in the European debt crisis of 2011 and 12. It's worth recalling that during these periods of stress, banks have become very nervous about their ability to access liquidity. This in turn made them nervous about lending to others, making the possibility of a severe credit crunch very real. By providing financial institutions with greater confidence about their own access to liquidity, central banks were able to support the supply of credit to the real economy. The CGFS report recognises that there were some side effects in doing this, but its strong conclusion is that these measures did ease liquidity strains in highly stressed bank funding markets, and they did help restore monetary transmission channels to the broader economy, so they were a success. The third policy tool discussed in the report is the outright purchase of assets from the private sector, paying for these assets by creating central bank reserves. This is also known as quantitative easing or QE. These asset purchases were on an unprecedented scale, and they led to very large expansions of central bank balance sheets, and you can see that in this chart. Before the financial crisis, the major central banks owned securities equivalent to around 5% of GDP. In recent years, this has risen to around 30%. As you can see in the chart, it's a very large change. As part of the QE program, central banks bought a wide range of assets, but the main asset purchase was government securities. Central banks now hold nearly 30% of government securities on issue, which is equivalent to around 20% of GDP. The largest purchases have been made by the Bank of Japan, which holds almost 50% of Japanese government bonds on issue. It's a large number. In the United States, the Federal Reserve also bought large quantities of agency-backed securities, which are backed by the US government. Elsewhere, central banks bought private securities, such as covered bonds, corporate bonds, and in some cases, commercial paper. And the Bank of Japan bought equities by exchange-traded funds and real estate investment trusts. So a broad range of assets have been purchased from the private sector by central banks as part of their QE programs. The precise motivations for these asset purchase programs differ across central banks. but a common motivation was to lower risk-free interest rates right along the yield curve, well beyond the short-term rate that central banks normally influence. Buying government securities was seen as reinforcing policy rate cuts and or acting as a substitute for further cuts once the policy rate had got to the effective lower bound. The expectation was that lower risk-free rates would flow through to most interest rates in the economy, that they would boost asset prices, and they'd push down the exchange rate, and it's done all that. A related motivation for buying government securities was to reinforce market expectations that policy rates were going to stay low for a long period of time. This signalling channel added to the downward pressure on the long-term bond yields. Another motivation in some countries was addressing specific problems in specific markets. In the United States, for example, the Federal Reserve purchased government-backed agency securities to support the mortgage market, and the Bank of England purchased commercial paper to ease highly stressed conditions in the corporate credit markets. Finally, the expansion of central bank balance sheets through money creation should, in theory, have stimulatory effects through the so-called portfolio balance channel. The idea here is that as a central bank purchases securities from the private sector and replaces those securities with the bank reserves, investors seek to rebalance their portfolios, and as they rebalance their portfolios, they push up other asset prices and lower risk premiums for borrowers. And in effect, these channels are supposed to stimulate the economy, although it's difficult to tell the impact of this particular portfolio balance channel from the other channels I spoke about. The fourth policy response was forward guidance. And this took two main forms, calendar-based and state-based. Under calendar-based guidance, the central bank makes an explicit commitment not to increase interest rates until a certain point in the future. Under state-based guidance, the central banks, it will not increase interest rates until specific economic conditions have been met. And in practice, we've seen examples of both around the world, and some central banks have also provided forward guidance about their asset purchase programs. A primary motivation of forward guidance is to reinforce the central bank's commitment to low interest rates. A related motivation is to provide greater clarity about the central bank's reaction function and strategy in unusual times. The experience with forward guidance has on balance been positive, and the guidance has helped to reduce uncertainty. There are, however, some examples where a change in the guidance caused market volatility. You probably all remember the taper tantrum in the United States in 2013 as an example of this. So these are the four unconventional policy tools discussed in the report: negative interest rates, liquidity support operations, purchasing assets from the private sector, and forward guidance. Before I discuss the relevance of all this to Australia, I want to make three broad observations drawing both on the report and my own reading of the evidence. The first is that there is strong evidence that the various liquidity support measures and targeted interventions in stressed markets were successful in calming things down and supporting the real economy. When markets broke down and they became dysfunctional, the actions of central banks did help stabilise the situation, and those actions did help avoid a damaging gridlock in the financial sector. They also helped contain risk premiums in highly stressed markets. It's also worth pointing out that many of these measures to support liquidity were successfully unwound once the job was done, so they proved to be temporary rather than a permanent intervention in markets. The CGFS report also documents the positive effects of some of the other unconventional measures. In general, though, I find this evidence less compelling. These various measures certainly pushed down long-term bond yields, and they did provide monetary stimulus in the depths of the crisis when it was needed most. But these extraordinary measures have continued way past the crisis period. In some countries, asset purchases have yet to be unwound, and it remains unclear when and even if they will be unwound. So a full evaluation is still not possible. And this brings me to my second general observation. and that is that there have been some side effects of the various unconventional measures. And I'll touch on a few of these that the CGFS report discusses. The first is that the extensive use of unconventional policy tools can change the incentives of others in the system, perhaps in an unhelpful way. It's possible that the willingness of a central bank to provide liquidity reduces the incentive of financial institutions to hold their own adequate liquidity buffers, making episodes of stress more likely in the future. It's also possible that the willingness of a central bank to use the full range of policy instruments might create an inaction bias by other policymakers, either the prudential regulators or the fiscal authorities. If this were the case, it would lead to an over-reliance on monetary policy. A second side effect is the impact on bank lending and the efficient allocation of resources in the economy. Persistently low or negative rates and a flattening of the yield curve can damage bank profitability, reducing the capacity of banks to lend. In some countries, there are also concerns that low interest rates allow less productive or these firms, these so-called zombie firms, to survive. And there are also financial stability risks that can come from low interest rates, boosting asset prices and borrowing at a time of weak economic growth. Normally, weak economic growth and rising asset prices don't go together, but this is what we've seen over recent times. So there are financial stability risks that come with that. A third possible side effect is the blurring of lines between monetary and fiscal policy. If the central bank is buying large amounts of government debt at zero interest rates, this could be seen as money-financed government spending. In some circumstances, this could damage the credibility of the country's institutional arrangements, and it could create political tensions. Political tensions can also arise if the central bank's asset purchases are seen to disproportionately benefit banks and benefit wealthy people at the expense of the person in the street. This perception has certainly arisen in some countries, despite the strong evidence that the various monetary measures have supported both jobs and incomes and thereby helped the entire community. So these are the various side effects that the CGFS report discusses, and we need to take them all seriously. The third general observation is that this experience suggests that a package of measures works best, with clear communication that enhances the credibility of that package. Exactly what the package looks like will vary from country to country, but it will depend upon the specific circumstances of that country. But clear communication from the central bank about its objectives and its approach is always important. The report also notes that there may be better solutions than monetary policy to solving the problems of the day. It reminds us that when there are problems on the supply side of the economy, the use of structural and fiscal policies will sometimes be the better approach. We need to remember that monetary policy cannot drive longer-term growth, but there are other arms of public policy that can sustainably promote both growth and investment. I would now like to turn to what all this implies for us here in Australia. And I'm going to make five sets of observations. The first is that the Reserve Bank has long had very flexible market operations that allow us to ensure adequate liquidity in the financial system. We have used this liquidity in the past, particularly during the global financial crisis, and we're prepared to use the flexibility that we have again in periods of stress if it's necessary to do so. At the moment, though, Australia's financial markets are operating normally and our financial institutions are able to access funding on reasonable terms. In any given currency, the Australian banks can raise funds at the same price as other similarly rated financial institutions around the world, and markets are not stressed. There's no dysfunction. So there is no need to change our normal market operations or to do anything unconventional here. Having said that, if markets were to become dysfunctional, you can be reassured by the fact that we have both the capacity and the willingness to respond. But this is not the situation we're in currently. Things are operating normally, and we don't need anything unconventional here. The second observation is that negative interest rates in Australia are extraordinarily unlikely. We are not in the same position that has been faced in Europe and Japan. Our growth prospects are stronger, our banking system is in much better shape, our demographic profile is better, and we've not had a period of deflation in Australia. So we're in a much stronger position than Europe and Japan, where they've had negative interest rates. More broadly, though, having examined the international evidence, it's not clear to me that the experience with negative interest rates has been a success. While negative interest rates have certainly put pressure, downward pressure on the exchange rate and helped lower long-term bond yields, they've come with other effects too. It's become increasingly clear to me that negative interest rates create strains in parts of the banking system that can impair the ability of banks to provide credit to businesses and households. Negative interest rates also create problems for pension funds that need to fund long-term liabilities. In addition, there's accumulating evidence that negative interest rates can encourage households to save more and spend less, especially when people are concerned about the possibility of lower income in retirement. A move to negative interest rates can also damage confidence in the economy as people worry about the future, and that the negative interest rates reinforce those worries. Given these considerations, it's not surprising that some analysts now talk about the reversal interest rate. That is the interest rate at which further cuts in the rate become contractionary rather than expansionary, turning the normal transmission on its head. While we take the possibility of a reversal rate seriously, I am confident that here in Australia, we're still a fair way from it. Conventional monetary policy in Australia is still working, and we see evidence of this in the exchange rate, in asset prices, and the boost to aggregate household disposable income. So we're not near the reversal rate, but we need to take that possibility seriously. My third observation is that we have no appetite to undertake outright purchases of private sector assets as part of a QE program. There are two reasons for this. The first is there are no signs of dysfunction in our capital markets that would warrant the Reserve Bank stepping in. Things are working normally, and I expect them to continue to do so. The second is that the purchase of private assets by the central bank, financed through money creation, represents a significant intervention by a public sector entity into private markets. It comes with a whole range of complicated governance issues and would insert the Reserve Bank very directly into decisions about resource allocation in the Australian economy. While there are some scenarios where such interventions might be considered inappropriate, those scenarios are not on our radar screen at the moment. My fourth point is that if, and it's important to stress the word if the Reserve Bank were to undertake a program of quantitative easing, we would purchase government bonds and we would do it in the secondary market. An important advantage of buying government bonds over other assets is that the risk-free interest rate affects all asset prices and all interest rates in our economy. So it gets into all the corners of the financial system, unlike interventions in just one specific private asset. If we were to move in this direction, it would be with the intention of lowering risk-free interest rates out along the yield curve. As with the international experience, this would work through two channels. The first is the direct price impact of buying government bonds, which obviously lowers their yields, and the second is through the market expectations or signalling effect, with the bond purchases reinforcing the credibility of the Reserve Bank's commitment to keep the cash rate low for an extended period. Thing is, you can see in this chart, the government bond yield curve at the moment currently sits around 20 basis points on average over the index, overnight index swap or OIS curve. Purchasing government securities would compress this differential and it could also flatten the OIS curve through the expectations or signalling effect I just mentioned. A lower term premium would lower borrowing costs for both governments and private businesses, and it would bring the benefits that come with that. And you could also expect an exchange rate effect from us buying government securities. Our current thinking is that QE becomes an option to be considered at a cash rate of 0.25%, but not before that. At a cash rate of 0.25%, the interest rate paid on surplus balances at the Reserve Bank would already be at zero given the corridor system that we operate. So from that perspective, we would, at that point, be effectively dealing with zero interest rates in Australia. My fifth and final point is that the threshold for undertaking QE in Australia has not been reached, and I don't expect it to be reached in the near term. In my view, there is not a smooth continuum running from interest rate reductions to quantitative easing. It's a bigger step to engage in money-financed asset purchase by the central bank than it is to cut interest rates, so there's a bigger hurdle. There are, however, circumstances where QE could help. The international experience is that in stressed market conditions, the central bank can help stabilise the situation by buying government securities. That experience also suggests that QE does put additional downward pressure on both interest rates and the exchange rate. We would need to balance these positive effects with the possible side effects in assessing the case for QE at an interest rate of 0.25%. We would also need to consider the effects on market functioning. We are conscious that government securities play a critical role as collateral in some of our financial markets. Given the limited supply of government debt on issue, the Reserve Bank and APRA have already had to put in place special liquidity arrangements for the banking system, so we'd have to take that into account. We're also conscious that the Australian government's fiscal position means that the gross stock of government debt is projected to decline relative to the size of the economy over the years ahead. These market considerations are not impediments to undertaking QE, but we would need to take them into account. It's a reasonable question to ask, what might be the threshold to undertake QE in Australia? It's difficult to be precise, but QE would be considered if there were an accumulation of evidence that over the medium time we're unlikely to achieve our objectives. In particular, if we were moving away from rather than towards our goals for both full employment and inflation, the purchase of government securities would be on the agenda of the Reserve Bank Board. In this world, I would hope other public policy options were also on the country's agenda. At the moment, though, we are expecting progress towards our goals over the next couple of years, and the cash rate is still above the level at which we would consider buying government securities. So QE is not on our agenda at this point in time. It's important to remember that the economy is benefiting from the already low level of interest rates, from the recent tax cuts, from ongoing high levels of spending on infrastructure, on the upswing in housing prices in some markets, and from a brighter outlook for the resources sector. So there are a number of things that are supporting growth at the moment. Given the significant reductions in interest rates that have taken place over the past 6 months and the long and variable lags, the board has seen it as appropriate to hold the cash rate steady as it assesses both the growth momentum here and the growth momentum elsewhere around the world. The board is also committed to maintaining interest rates at low levels until it is confident that inflation is sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range. It's also important to remember that the central scenario for the Australian economy remains for economic growth to gradually pick up from here to reach around 3% in 2021. This expected pickup in growth should see a reduction in the unemployment rate, and it should see a lift in inflation. So we are expecting things to be moving in the right direction, although they're only moving in the right direction gradually. The board continues to discuss what role it can play in ensuring that this progress takes place and how it might be accelerated. It recognises the benefits that would come from faster progress, but it also recognises the limitations of monetary policy and the importance of keeping a medium-term perspective squarely focused on maximising the economic welfare of the people of Australia. There may come a point where QE would help promote that collective welfare, but we are not at that point, and I don't expect us to get there. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thanks, Phil, for a fantastically candid speech. And as Phil has said, he's happy to take some questions from the floor. We have two microphones, one here and one here. Please, when asking a question, state your name and your affiliation, and please keep your questions very short. Okay.
Dr. Lowe, thank you very much for your very informative speech. It feels as though it was an important occasion. Adam Donaldson from Commonwealth Bank. I had two questions. I think they're both short answers, so hopefully that's okay. One is, does government bonds include state government bonds? And the second one is, does the 0.25 threshold that you mentioned for delivering on QE or thinking about it equal the effective lower bound that you mentioned in the first part of your speech?
Does it include state government and other bonds? The answer to that is it could. We'll have to wait and see. We haven't got that far yet, and I'm hoping that we don't reach that point, but certainly that could be a possibility. The second point is kind of, does 0.25 effectively represent the ELB, the effective lower bound? I think the answer to that is yes. Because a cash rate of 25 basis points, the rate the Reserve Bank is paying on bank reserves is effectively zero, would be zero on most bank reserves. So in most other countries, you'd call that zero interest rates. I see that as the effective lower bound. Our appetite, as you could probably tell from my remarks, for a zero cash rate and hence negative interest rates on central bank reserves is very, very limited, and I don't think we're going to go there. So I think kind of a cash rate minimum of 25 basis points is the effective lower bound.
Ivan Cahoon from NAB. I just wanted to warm you up before Rory gets to the mic as well. So question about the unemployment rate. So you've been changing the emphasis a little bit of the mandate from just the sole focus on inflation. What needs to transpire to make you think that you're not going towards the the drop in the unemployment rate? How long do you think you'd need to have evidence that unemployment was gradually creeping higher?
When we look at what's going on in the labour market, it's obviously really important. The thing that's kind of surprised me over recent times is the rise in labour force participation. We've had, over the last 4 years, employment growth averaging 2.25%, maybe 2.5%. So we've been able to generate a lot of jobs in Australia. But the unemployment rate's hardly moved, because when we generate all these jobs, there's strong growth in labour supply as well. So strong labour demand, strong labour supply. So the wage growth is not really changing. What the unemployment rate's going to do from here, it's very hard to tell, because it's going to depend upon the balance of demand and supply. I'm expecting employment growth to slow from where it's been, but still be quite reasonable, and it's possible that's enough to bring the unemployment rate down, but it really depends on labour supply, and the truth is we're not very good at forecasting what happens there. So what's really important is that we continue to have strong labour demand. And while we're seeing strong labour demand, it's less concerning the unemployment rate's not coming down than in an environment where labour demand was weak. So I don't think it's as simple as saying we're just looking at the unemployment rate, we're really looking at labour demand as well. And labour demand has been strong. It's a positive story for the Australian economy that we've generated all these jobs.
Okay, thank you.
Ross Gittins of the Herald. We finally had an end to soaring house prices, but then you cut rates by just three times and house prices seem to be going up again. How concerned are you about that?
Well, I wouldn't attribute the rise in housing prices solely to our handiwork. I think the re-election of the coalition government removed some of the uncertainty about taxation of residential properties, and there has been some easing of prudential requirements. And the other thing we've noticed is that some of the markets are tightening up because of the balance again between supply and demand. New construction activity slowing and population still growing strong in Australia, so the vacancy rates in many markets, with the exception of Sydney, are quite low, and that's putting upward pressure on prices. So there are other things going on other than interest rates. How worried are we? At the moment, not particularly worried. We would be worried, though, if we saw credit growth pick up materially in response to the higher housing prices. Loan approvals have risen a bit over recent months, but aggregate credit outstanding growth has hardly lifted at all. So at the moment, we're not seeing things on the debt side that are causing us concern, and ultimately that's what's important for us. Household debt and the vulnerabilities to the economy that come from high levels of household debt, and we don't see that getting worse at the moment. But if it did, it would be an issue. If credit growth were to pick up materially from here, and lending standards were to weaken, that would be something that would be concerning us, but that's not the situation we're in.
Hi, Matt Barry here. Central banks typically cut policy rates by 300 basis points to 600 basis points when they head into recession. We've had about 26 years of uninterrupted growth. The IMF paper that you mentioned talks about a hypothetical scenario where central banks cut their policy rate from 2% to -4%. To do that, the IMF also talks about having to do strange things such as banning cash. Treasury is already starting to do that in Australia with potentially the $10,000 cash ban. Question to you is, what do you think the likelihood is that Australia heads into recession, given 26 years of growth? At some point it's going to happen soon. You've said you're two cuts away potentially from QE. Given the fact that a central bank typically has to cut 300 basis points to 600 basis points, you don't have much room to move. What's the likelihood we'll head into recession, and if we do head into recession, what will the RBA do about that?
Well, I think the likelihood of recession is low. I mean, our central scenario is for growth to pick up and to be 3% in a couple of years' time, so a recession is a long way from that. The growth in the economy is being supported by the low interest rates, the tax cuts, spending on infrastructure, the better outlook in the resources sector, and pick up in housing prices and the depreciation of the currency. With all those things going for us, and strong population growth, I think the probability of a recession is quite low. What are the policy options if I'm wrong and we find ourselves in that position? We would consider, as I talked about, buying government securities. That would be an option for the Reserve Bank. And, of course, we shouldn't forget about fiscal policy in that situation.
Would you buy mortgages?
Would we buy residential mortgage-backed securities? That's not on our list of options at the moment, mainly for two reasons. We don't see dysfunction in the RMBS in the mortgage market. Our mortgage market is working well. So if we did see dysfunction in the mortgage market and we thought that we could overcome that dysfunction by buying RMBS, that would be on our agenda. But at the moment, our mortgage market is working well. And as I said in my prepared remarks, buying government securities is a much more attractive option than buying residential mortgage-backed securities, because the risk-free rate, which is what government securities is, gets into all the cracks in the financial system. And so that would be a much more effective tool than buying residential mortgage-backed securities in that situation. But again, I think the probability we'll end up there is quite low. We've got a lot of positives going for us.
Dr. Lowe, Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. Today we saw the chairman and CEO of Westpac depart after a money laundering scandal. Do you think they made the right decision? and my second question, if I may, you mentioned financial stability as a side effect of quantitative easing. Do you think if we do get down that path that you may reconsider or whether macroprudential policy may be part of a QE package? Thanks.
On Westpac, I'm not going to comment on whether the board made the right decision, but I do want to say I find the allegations against Westpac appalling and completely unacceptable. We demand very high standards from our financial institutions, and it's right we demand high standards, and it's right we expect those standards to be met, and when they're not met, there needs to be accountability. It's important also we understand how this happened and the investigations by APRA, ASIC, AUSTRAC, not the Reserve Bank, and the management of Westpac are hopefully going to throw the spotlight on how this happened, because hopefully there are lessons for everyone here. And the second question, I didn't really fully understand, would we consider macroprudential
instruments? Well, you mentioned as one of the side effects of quantitative easing being financial stability. I just wondered if you were planning to that degree as to whether macroprudential policy may form part of a QE package to manage.
Well, it wouldn't be part of a QE package, but we would consider it in conjunction with APRA. If we saw in response to even lower interest rates, credit growth pick up a lot and banks loosen lending standards a lot. I suspect we won't see that, because the environment in which we're moving interest rates down to 25 basis points and buying government securities, it's not likely to be an environment where you're seeing banks kind of go crazy lending, is it? But if they did, then we would consider macroprudential instruments together with APRA, but I don't think it's particularly likely.
Sophia Rodriguez from Central Bank Intel. A study by ECB, I think it was conducted earlier this year, showed that the transmission from wages growth to inflation takes several years, and it takes longer when interest rates are in a low interest rate setting. So if the same applies here, given that we have an outlook for stable wages growth, how long will it take for us for inflation? First we need to have wages. First we need to see acceleration in wages growth, and then increase in inflation. So how many years are we looking at?
Well, I think it's going to take quite a long time. And as you say, the transmission mechanism from interest rates to inflation works through kind of labour demand, then wages, and then wages go up and inflation goes up. And the first part of this process seems to be working well. Lower interest rates are encouraging strong labour demand, but it's not encouraging a pickup in wages. In our latest forecasts, we're projecting wage growth to really stay around where it is for a reasonable period of time. So the things going on in the labour market partly related to labour supply, but there are structural things going on as well, which means that strong labour demand is not translating into pickup in wages. And even when wages pick up, there is some capacity for the profit share to come down. So I'm expecting there to be quite a delay to pick up in inflation. So it's a very gradual process. The important thing for us, we're moving in the right direction. And if we thought in the fullness of time we weren't going to get there, we'd have to change direction. But at the moment, we still think in the fullness of time we'll get there. We just have to be patient. And because of structural changes going on in the economy, we have to accept that. We'd like to get back to 2.5% inflation more quickly, but there are structural factors at work that mean it's difficult for us to do it.
Governor Lowe, Paul Bloxham from HSBC. I think this is probably one of the most complex speeches that I've heard you give. It is a very complicated area, and this is a room of financial professionals who can keep up with this material. But as you described, if we end up doing, or the RBA ends up doing, sovereign bond purchases, if you drift into it, it's not a continuum, but you get to the point where you just have to do it. How are you going to communicate this to the Australian public in a way that suggests that we're just moving from having used the cash rate to using sovereign bond purchases to deliver monetary policy? How is it going to happen in a way that still ensures confidence about the outlook and so on, if there isn't a shock? I mean, I can understand how you get there. If there's a big shock, the world changes and you have to deliver QE, and then you say, well, that's the reason. But if you're drifting into it as a part of the monetary policy toolkit, how do you explain this to a general public that, so that it actually delivers what you want, which is an improvement in the economy?
Well, I wouldn't accept the characterisation we're going to drift into this. And the scenario where we're buying government securities is one where we're moving persistently away from our targets for full employment and the inflation target. So if that were to be the case, and I don't expect it to be, but if it were, then that would be the basis on which we'd be explaining to the Australian public that we're moving away from full employment and we're moving away from the inflation target and that we need to do something. And again, as I said in my prepared remarks, I'd hope other arms of policy would be doing something as well if inflation were declining and the unemployment rate were increasing. Be all arms to the wheel, wouldn't it? It should be. Whether that's what happens or not, I think it's important that we don't just focus on that negative scenario. We're a long way from that happening. I don't expect us to get there. It's possible, but I don't expect us to get there. The central scenario, with all the things that are supporting the Australian economy at the moment, remains reasonable for us. And we're a long way from moving materially away from our targets. We think we're going to get there. It's just going to take some time. And because the Reserve Bank Board is very squarely focused on the medium term, we're prepared to let this process roll out as long as we feel we're going to get there in the fullness of time, which I think we will. So don't focus on the negativity. There are a lot of positive things. I could read out my list again if you want, but I think you get the point.
Matt Sherwood, Perpetual Investments. Governor, thank you very much for your speech. Going back to your threshold of when you'd use QE, namely the accumulation of evidence that we're not going to achieve our growth and inflation targets, when you look back at QE through time, the US Federal Reserve has done three programs and yet it's hit its inflation target in 6 months of the past 10 years. European Central Bank has done a bigger program, yet it last hit its inflation target in 2003. Bank of Japan, you're going back to the early 1990s. So how do you balance the poor track record of QE lifting inflation back to target against all the financial distortions that it does create, where infrastructure assets trade like they're riskless assets when they're not? Even in the share market this year, nearly every market has falling earnings growth, and yet share market returns have been pretty robust, driven by valuation expansion. So how do you balance the poor track record against the financial distortions that a QE program does create?
I wouldn't accept your characterisation here. The QE programs, particularly the first round in the United States, did help stave off a very severe financial crisis. If that financial crisis had manifested itself, unemployment would have gone even higher in the United States and inflation would have been even lower. So these quantitative easing programs and the other unconventional measures did stave that off. So I think they made a very significant contribution to both employment and inflation being closer to the target. The question is, do you continue to get benefit from doing this? And if you read the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee's minutes this week, They had an evaluation of their QE experiences, and they suggested that perhaps there are diminishing returns as you do this more. And they also suggested that perhaps it's less effective when interest rates are already very low levels. That would be both conclusions that I would agree with. So I think in the end this has worked, but does it keep working? As you do more and more of it, I think there's a question mark over that.
It seems the relationship between the economy and the financial markets is becoming more unstable. And I agree in 2008, saved us probably from another Great Depression, but I tend to think it's creating more problems, QE, than it's actually solving. What's your...
The Federal Reserve is not doing QE at the moment, so you're really talking about the Japanese and the Europeans again. And the low level of interest rates, particularly in Europe, is causing problems in the financial system there. And I hear reports from my colleagues in other central banks where households are worrying about their pensions in the future. They're saying interest rates are negative. My pension fund might even be cut the nominal pension and I've got to save more. So I'm hearing more and more stories like that. So I think the negative interest rates are having a deleterious effect. Whether QE is part of that, I'm not sure. But there is an issue if QE is boosting asset prices at a time of slowing growth. Because normally asset prices go up when things are going well, don't they? They don't really normally rise when the outlook is uncertain and deteriorating. So to the extent that QE is facilitating that and causing it, I think it is an issue.
Thanks.
But you've got to look at the whole picture together rather than just take one bit at a time. Just two more. Yeah, a couple more.
Hi there, Dr. Lowe. It's Gareth Aird from Commonwealth Bank. Look, earlier today, your colleague Guy DeBell delivered a speech on wages and employment. And I can't remember the exact wording that he used, but he said something to the effect of low wages growth is the new norm, or it's become entrenched. And it kind of got me thinking, well, if low wages growth is the new norm, is the inflation target of 2 to 3% still the appropriate one if we are indeed in an environment where wages growth with a two handle on it is something we've got to get used to? I just wanted to get your thoughts on the inflation target in the context of what Guy DeBell said today around low wages growth being the new norm.
Well, I think the inflation target where we are is the right place to be. You might have noticed that the Treasurer and I recently agreed to keep the statement on the conduct of monetary policy unchanged, with the centrepiece being the 2 to 3% inflation target. So we don't see a need to change that, and neither does the government, and for good reason. I would take issue with you when you say we've got to get used to wage increases at 2%. I don't think my colleague said that. He said that in the society at the moment, wage increases around 2% have become a norm. Now, it used to be in Australia that people would get 3 or 4% wage increases. That was what we'd kind of expect year in, year out. But what people are getting used to at the moment are wage increases of 2 or 2.25% or 2.5%. And he was sharing the concerns that we have, that is becoming a norm, that people think that's what you get here. We don't have to get used to that, though, and we shouldn't get used to that. I think in the medium term, wage growth in Australia should average 3.5% at least. We want to deliver you an average rate of inflation of 2.5%, and I hope the economy can generate at least 1% a year labour productivity growth, and if workers get their normal share of that, they should get 1% increase in real wages a year. So 1% for real wage increases and 2.5% inflation equals 3.5%. I hope that's where we get back to. That's kind of almost central bank nirvana. Inflation at target, full employment, and real wage increases, keeping the profit share kind of broadly constant over long periods of time. So that's where we should be trying to get to. How do we get there? That's the question that we've been asking ourselves. What we see in the United States and Germany and the UK, if you can push the unemployment rate down to a very low level, the labour market does get tight enough, wage growth does pick up, and in the US, wage growth recently has been above 3%. But the experience of those three countries is you need to get the unemployment rate down lower than the previous estimate of full employment. I think that's quite possible here as well. How do we get the unemployment rate down to 4.5% or below 4%? That's the issue that the country faces, because I think we need to do that to get wage growth back to 3 or 3.5%, which is where it needs to be. We shouldn't give up hope that we can do that. I think we will get there. It's just going to take time. We've got to get the unemployment rate down and create a tight labour market so that firms once again compete more aggressively for workers and workers have the confidence to go and ask for a pay rise. And we know from the experience elsewhere around the world that that does eventually work. It just takes longer than it used to. We have to be patient and we have to keep trying to generate strong labour demand to create a tight labour market. Sorry, that's...
Last question.
Yeah.
I'm Rory.
Rory, normally you're first.
Tonight I'm last. Thank you very much for your presentation tonight, Governor Lowe, and thank you for waiting to deliver it to the annual dinner of the Australian Business Economist. This should fill up the coffers. We've got tables of high school students and we've got some teachers. I wonder if you could put the sort of the current situation in some sort of a historical context, in that when you and I were boys studying economics in country Australia, one of the key variables was the misery index. So you add the unemployment rate with the inflation rate and get a sizable number. Often unemployment, or a couple of times in recessions, unemployment was above 10%. Inflation often was 8, 10, 12%. So 20% wasn't sort of outrageous, and that was the focus of policy, was to get that down. And today we're wringing our hands at a time when the misery index is about 7. So, 5.3% unemployment plus 1.6% core inflation is about 7. So in some respects, this is a giant win for macroeconomics, but somehow that's not how it feels. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how we got here, that the low misery index isn't a win anymore.
So the question is really kind of, well, why does it feel like things aren't so good when they're actually quite reasonable? I think we need to keep this in perspective. You look at, again, overseas, the US has the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. In the UK, I hear the governor, Mark Carney, at the Bank of England, say our unemployment rate's the lowest in 40 years. In Germany, it's the lowest in 35 years. And in Australia, the employment to population ratio is the highest it's ever been in Australian history. A higher share of the Australian population have a job today than ever before in our history. So there are plenty of jobs out there. Why don't people feel good? I think it's the income growth that's not coming along with the jobs. Back to the previous question, we've had 5 or 6 years now where wage growth has been kind of 2.5. So people have not had an increase in their real wage effectively for 5 or 6 years. And as that goes on longer and longer, people feel unhappy. So there are dynamics going on in the labour market which mean that wage growth is not coming in the rate that used to come. Job growth is coming, but wage growth is not coming, and it's creating disillusionment in the population. So I think kind of it's in our national interest for wage growth to pick up and return to this benchmark over time, not tomorrow, but over time, of 3.5%. I think that's where the economy should be capable of that, and it'd make people feel better. So I'm hoping we get there. Can I just add one other point in the broader context about why we have lower interest rates? Is because it's very different from when you and I first started studying economics, when we kind of interest rates were 15 and 17%, and now they're kind of close to zero right around the world. Why is that happening? Now, a lot of people at the moment write to me and blame the central bank, blame me. And my colleagues and other governors of other central banks have similar experiences. But we feel like we're responding to some really big global forces, and the central banks are the ones that happen to deliver low interest rates for the society, but we're really responding to some global forces. And the main global forces are an elevated appetite to save at the moment and a depressed appetite to invest. When lots of people want to save and not many businesses want to use the savings to invest in new productive capital, what do you think the savers are going to get, high or low returns? The high school economics question, they're going to get low returns. A lot of demand, a lot of supply and not much demand. The price is going to be low. So there's a lot of saving globally at the moment because a huge share of the population globally is in the 40 to 60-year age group where people save a lot and people are living for longer in retirement, so you have to save even more. Asia's growing, and in Asia people save a lot because the social safety net isn't very well developed. And people have borrowed a lot in the past, and eventually the intertemporal budget constraint bites and you've got to pay back the debt or kind of reduce your consumption. So demographics, Asia, and the intertemporal budget constraint all mean that there's a lot of saving going on. And on investment, it's depressed. The global trade uncertainties are meaning businesses right around the world are nervous, so they're sitting on their hands, they're not investing. Population growth in the advanced economies is the lowest it's been in decades, so there isn't need to replicate the existing capital stock for a growing population. And these things are really depressing investment.
And Governor Lowe, since...
So that's kind of... That's the world we're in, lots of saving. And so my last point I wanted to make, and this is the solution to this, is to get businesses to invest, to give businesses the confidence to invest, expand, innovate and hire people. And so that... businesses want to use the high pool of global savings to build new productive assets, then savers will get higher returns and the pressure will come off low interest rates globally. So that's the solution to improve the business investment climate. If we can't do that, the saving ratios are going to stay high right around the world. We've got to get firms wanting to use those savings again. Sorry. So it was a long answer, but you gave me a broad landscape.
Final one, confirming what you were saying on QE. So I think you've said that the Reserve Bank has little appetite for QE right now. The outlook is reasonably bright. But everything's up for grabs in the next recession. I think you've said next time that if unemployment's rising and inflation's falling, which typically is in a recession or in a real soft patch, that's when QE might come to the fore. That's my question.
It's possible, but there are, remember, monetary policy is not the solution to every problem. There are other solutions in that environment that that might be more attractive or might not. I don't know. But if the unemployment rate were rising materially, inflation was moving away from target, I think all options would need to be on the table.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Please thank Phil again.